Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today our program will visit Bates College Museum of Art in Lewiston for a talk by Douglas Vakoch, the Director of Interstellar Message Composition at the SETI Institute, SETI being the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Dr. Vakoch researches ways that different civilizations might create messages that could be transmitted across interstellar space, allowing communication between humans and extraterrestrials, even without face-to-face contact. He's particularly interested in how we might compose messages that would begin to express what it's like to be human. If you enjoy this program and would like a copy for yourself, one can be purchased by calling MPBN's audience services at 1-800-884-1717. I'll give that information again at the end of the program. This program will also be archived online at mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Anthony Shostak, Curator of Education for the Bates College Museum of Art.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's final lecture in our Cosmic Questions series, Aesthetics for Aliens, Art, Music, and Extraterrestrials by Doug Vakoch. My name is Anthony Shostak. I'm the Curator of Education for the Bates College Museum of Art and the lead curator on the Starstruck project to which tonight's lecture is associated. And it's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Doug Vakoch. He's the Director of Interstellar Message Composition at the SETI Institute, which I think is probably the coolest job title I've ever come across. He's also Professor of Clinical Psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He leads the SETI Institute's project to compose interstellar messages of the kind that may someday be sent in reply to a signal from extraterrestrials. Dr. Vakoch is chair of the International Academy of Astronautics Study Groups on Interstellar Message Composition and Active SETI. As a member of the International Institute of Space Law, he examines policy issues related to interstellar communication. Dr. Vakoch has published widely in scholarly books and journals in psychology, astronautics, and the relationship between the arts and sciences. His work has been featured in newspapers and magazines such as the New York Times, Nature, Science, and Der Spiegel. As a spokesman on the cultural aspects of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, he's been interviewed on radio and television shows, including the BBC, NPR, ABC, the Learning Channel, the Discovery Channel, and others. His recent books include Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence, Civilizations Beyond Earth, Extraterrestrial Life and Society, and Psychology of Space Exploration, Contemporary Research in Historical Perspective. Please join me in welcoming Doug Vakoch.
Thank you very much. When you hear about the organizations who have sponsored this talk, the departments of rhetoric and anthropology and psychology, I think it gives you a sense of the scope of the activities that are needed to really grapple with this idea. How in the world could we ever hope to communicate with an extraterrestrial intelligence? Well, I'd like to give you some ideas of how we've been attempting to do that at the SETI Institute and with scientists and people from the humanities and arts from around the world over the past decade and more. And then I'd like to end with an invitation to each of you to help us decide what we should say to another civilization and let you know how you can go online and send us the message that you think that we should be saying if, in fact, someday we get a call from an extraterrestrial intelligence. Now, when you hear the title Aesthetics for Aliens, you might imagine that what I'm going to be talking about is how do we communicate with those aliens who are coming to Earth and doing sometimes untoward things toward us. But that's not what I'm talking about, although coming to Bates College, you'd be very reasonable to think that. Actually, Bates is the home of faculty member Stephanie Kelly Romano, who's really the world's foremost authority on rhetorical analysis of alien abductions and UFOs. So if you want the scoop, Bates is the right place to come. But unfortunately, that's not where my expertise is. Mine lies a bit more distant from Earth. And so we're looking for signals from folks who haven't been able to get here yet. And it's an area that actually has a very long history. It isn't just more recently that we've been looking for signs of intelligence or thinking how we might communicate with it, but even back in the 19th century, people as renowned as the Austrian mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss suggested that if there are intelligent beings on the moon, and back in the early 19th century that seemed likely, people didn't know that there was no atmosphere on the moon. Well, he said, what you might do is let them know that we're savvy about geometry. So go to the forests of Siberia, carve out some geometrical areas, plant wheat fields in the middle of these forests, and show them that we, too, know about the Pythagorean theorem. So you can do that as one way of communicating in a very visual way with nearby aliens, relatively nearby if they were inhabitants on the moon. And during about the same time period, Josef von Littrow suggested doing something similar, but on the dark side of the Earth. So he said, go to the Sahara Desert, carve canals 10, 20 miles in diameter in the sands of the Sahara, fill them with kerosene, light them up, and in the night side of the Earth as it's pointing the moon, that will let extraterrestrials who are inhabiting the moon know that we know something about the importance of circles and perhaps suggesting something about pi. So the idea of communicating with beings beyond Earth is not a new one, but it has really taken off, especially in the last 50 years, with the creation of radio technologies that let us look for signals that are no stronger than the signals that we, too, could transmit to another civilization. So before that, you'd have to look close to home, you know, the moon or the Mars. The more we know about our solar system, the more skeptical we are that there's intelligent life here. Maybe there'll be some fossilized life on Mars someday that we'll find. But no one's counting on there being other intelligent life in our solar system. So we look beyond our solar system, and for that we use telescopes like the Allen Telescope Array that the SETI Institute operates in Northern California, where we use an array of individual dishes that are electronically linked together to let us look for signals from space. And so there's a big emphasis in the modern search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, on using computers. So there's a lot of data coming in, and the bottleneck is really how fast can we process all that data that's coming in. It's something that we have people overseeing, but really a lot of the work is automated. And what we're looking for is a signal that will stand out from the cosmic static. So for example, you know, one of the challenges of the work that we do is to make sure that our search system is even working well. I mean, if in fact we're looking for a signal from another star, but yet we haven't found any extraterrestrials, how do we make sure that we're even able to detect the kind of things we're looking for? Well, one of the things we do is look for transmissions that are very similar. For example, the Voyager spacecraft launched by NASA in the 1970s are now, you know, at the edge of our solar system, but still transmitting back very weak signals. And so if we can pick those signals up, those are very similar to the sorts of signals that we're looking for from another civilization. And so we look for recurrent patterns, very narrow signals. If you think of it like a signal on the radio dial, we're looking for something that's at one spot on the radio dial. And that's in contrast to the sort of signals that stars and galaxies give out that are spread across the radio dial. So if we find what we're looking for, it either means we've found some radically new kind of natural phenomenon, or we've actually found a signal from ET. And the search that we're doing right now is to look for signals from around stars that we know to have planets. In the early days of SETI, we looked at sun-like stars or stars that were near Earth because we didn't know which stars had planets. But as you follow in the newspapers, you realize that now Hundreds of stars are known to have planets around them. And so we focus our search on stars that have been detected as having planets by NASA's Kepler mission. And the significance of Kepler is we're looking for stars that have Earth-like planets around them. And so in the coming year or so, we should know how prevalent Earth-sized planets are around other stars. And so when we start up our observations tonight at 7:30, we'll be pointing toward the sky. And for those of you who want to take part in our search, I invite you to go online. Just go to SETILive.org, and you can help us with a new phase of trying to figure out if extraterrestrials are sending us a signal. You know, what we've been focusing on the past is having the computers do all of the detection of patterns, but maybe there's something that our computers are missing that you can pick up just by looking at the signals. So we're doing this two-prong approach now. Go to SETILive.org and help us out as the data is coming in to tell us whether you see a signal. And if we get a lot of people saying, yes, I see a signal, that can affect our next step in the search strategy and actually go back and check and see if it's really there. Well, if we do get a signal, what are we to do next? Should we send a reply back? And if we do, how could we create something that would be understandable? In a sense, we're trying to come up with a cosmic Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone, you may recall, was the key to breaking the Egyptian hieroglyphs. There was one language that we didn't understand, Egyptian, in two versions, but we did understand the Greek, and so the same text was written in three parallel languages, and that provided the key to understanding a previously unknown language, Egyptian. So the question is, can we come up with something that serves the function of being a cosmic Rosetta Stone that would enable us to communicate with another civilization, even though they're hundreds or thousands of light years away from here? And that translates into trillions and trillions of miles away from here. So what that means is if we send a signal out traveling at the speed of light, it could well take decades or centuries or millennia for a round-trip exchange. So the challenge is to create something that is as meaningful and as easy to understand as possible. And the question is, what then would extraterrestrials and humans have in common? Probably won't be English or Swahili or Chinese. What then can serve as a common language? Well, what is it that we know that humans and extraterrestrials have in common? Well, if we get a signal in the first place, we know that they have the technology to send the signal. And so we think about what is it that you need to know in order to create the technology to make communication possible. And one likely thing that you need to know if you're going to build a radio transmitter is at least a bit of basic mathematics. I mean, it's hard to think of building a huge radio telescope if you don't know that 2 + 2 = 4. And so how then might we start with something as simple as counting to communicate something about ourselves? So imagine we got a series of pulses that came in that just were counting the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, it would give us a pattern that would say, you know, we don't know anything in nature that can create this. That in itself would be a sign that we've detected a signal from an intelligent being. But imagine we got a little bit more complicated pattern. So we got the pattern 1, 4, 9, 16, 25, 36, 49. What is that pattern that we're seeing here? We're seeing the number squared. It's multiplied by itself. So 1 × 1 = 1. 2 × 2 = 4. 3 × 3 = 9. 4 × 4 = 16, etc. 7 × 7 = 49. And so if we got a signal like that, it might even give us a hint about the format of another part of the message to come. So imagine, in fact, that what the other civilization wants to tell us is they're showing us pictures, sort of creating a grid, and using that grid to communicate some information. So imagine they send a series of pulses, 49 pulses, 49 pulses, 49 pulses, slightly different frequencies. And we put those 49 pulses together, and it's a 7x7 grid. And what we find is that the outside of that grid is sort of a frame for the inside of a picture. So say we have the outside of a frame, let's think of it as being black, but it's really sent as a one type of frequency. And then a slightly different frequency, other pulses are sent. And so what we might do is actually use that frame to send messages to show some very simple counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Of course, the problem if you're using such a small grid is by the time you get to 25, you have to stop counting. You can't go any higher than that. So when we think about the kind of numbering system we'd want to use to communicate with extraterrestrials, we often think of something that's more compact and in some sense even simpler, a binary numbering system where the first digit is 1. Are there any 1s? No, there aren't. Or yes, there's 1, 1. Are there any 2s? Yes, there's a 2. If there's a 1 and a 2, then you have a 3. Are there any 4s? And so we can have a very compact number in a very small space that can be very large. And so what we might imagine is getting a series of these individual frames that, when connected together, might give us a pattern that scientists on other worlds and scientists on our worlds might understand as well. Because if we think about counting, the question might be, what is it that you'd want to count? One of the things that astronomers count when they're trying to characterize the universe they're trying to understand is they're trying to count characteristics related to the chemical composition. And so when you think about atoms, one way to characterize atoms is counting the number of protons that they have in their nucleus. And that differentiates one chemical element from another element. And lo and behold, we have the periodic table of elements. Now, for those of you who are chemists, this isn't usually the format of the periodic table you see it. But, you know, we might expect some little variations in how you lay this whole thing out. But if, in fact, the folks on the other end of the long-distance line are scientists trying to understand the universe as well, they may understand some of these same basic patterns that are describable in some very simple numbering systems that really relate to universals of science. And in fact, some of the messages that have been sent have attempted to tap into some of those universal ideas of chemistry. In the 1990s and early 2000s, some transmissions were sent from the Ukraine, a transmitter in Evpatoria, that included some diagrams of our DNA. And so we might imagine sending information to other civilizations that really try to start with some of the commonalities that we have in our physical cosmos, and then step by step build up talking about our understanding of how the galaxy formed, our understanding of how solar systems form, our understanding of how life originates. And some of those processes may also be understood by scientists on other worlds, but yet there may be something idiosyncratic about, for example, how life has originated and evolved on Earth, how culture has originated and evolved on Earth. So we might take science as a starting place to communicate with another civilization, but also a starting place that, though some aspects might be recognizable, could also be different across cultures, across civilizations. And that's been one of the goals that the SETI Institute has had of trying to look at ways that we can communicate not just our scientific understanding of ourselves, but what it really means to be human, cognizant of the fact that sometimes there may be links between math and science and the way we understand ourselves. We've had a number of workshops. In fact, one of the exhibitors of the it's in the Starstruck exhibition here at Bates College, took part in one of our workshops in Paris where we were talking about what are some of the visual universals that an extraterrestrial might comprehend. One of the meetings we had was to think about one of the seeming prerequisites for communication with another civilization, altruism. I mean, as we go to our computers and our telescope tonight and are listening for signals from another civilization, we're looking for intentionally transmitted signals. What that means is that someone is sending us something that you could argue is for our benefit and doesn't do them any good. In some sense, it seems like it might be an indication of altruism. Although there are a lot of different kinds of altruism, too. Maybe there's some people talk about reciprocal altruism. Maybe they're doing the first good turn and hoping for something positive in response. But we might think about how we would communicate notions of altruism if we want to talk about some of our highest ideals on Earth. And one of the things you find as you look at altruism is that there are some ways to at least begin describing altruism in scientific terms. So one of the things you'll discover, and this isn't just restricted to humans, but in a number of other animal species as well, is that an individual is more likely to be self-sacrificing if the beneficiaries are closely related. And the idea is that even though you may be putting your life on the line, the one who benefits has something in common with you. And part of what's in common with you is your genetics. And so that even though you might be sacrificing your life, part of your same genetic material is carried on if you're ensuring the survival of a brother or sister or a child. And so once we can communicate some basic notions of chemistry and we can describe genetics in terms of biochemistry, that gives us a way to start talking about something as seemingly abstract as altruism. Now, of course, altruism isn't restricted to this doing something for someone else only because that you're related to them. You know, we have ideals of being sacrificing for strangers even, where there is no opportunity to get a payback. And so if we want to communicate those sorts of notions of altruism, we might need to move to something like an interstellar morality play. Imagine something like a computer-generated message that shows one person helping another person, a person suspended over the edge of a cliff, and someone else coming down, even though it's risky, and saving the person, bringing the person to safety. But altruism, as we usually use it, means that there is some risk. So if we really want to communicate what altruism means, we might contrast that successful altruism, where it's successful for the altruist not being harmed in the end, with other alternatives, such as the altruist coming to help, but in the process, dying. Or we might also emphasize that part of altruism is it's not just this hardwired thing that we have to be altruistic, but in seeing someone in distress, we also have, as human beings, the option to walk away. And so there are ways that we can begin describing ourselves, even in these sort of morality plays, stories that we tell about how we interact with one another, what the implications of our actions are, and even starting to describe ourselves in very physical terms. I mean, one of the things about human beings at the beginning of this century is that we are still very fragile, very mortal beings. And if we imagine the sorts of intelligence that we may communicate with in the future, if they are more advanced than we are, something like mortality may be a distant memory to them. So this may be one of the more interesting things that we could tell another civilization and also a central part of our identity. Well, even to talk about showing people interacting with one another supposes that something like gestures can be intelligible to another civilization. There's been a long-standing attempt to understand the universality of gestures. And I think one of the truths here on Earth is that often the gestures we use end up being much more ambiguous than we would like to think. Or they sometimes say more about ourselves than we would like to, or things that we're not especially proud of. So in the early 1970s, when NASA launched two Pioneer spacecraft, they included 6 by 9 inch plaques that included, among other things, greetings. And one of the responses to this plaque was, wait a second, why is it that the man is doing the greeting and the woman is standing demurely to his side? And so when the Voyager spacecraft was sent a few years later, a similar image was sent, but now with the woman taking the more dominant greeting role and the man standing more passively beside. But would a message like an upraised hand really convey a sense of hello or we come in peace, we're not holding a weapon to another civilization? I think it's doubtful, at least not with a lot of unpacking of what we mean by our gestures and perhaps even how we see. You know, you might say, well, show them something concrete like a human body. Well, so here's something concrete, a human body. As it's depicted, if we think of the way the Maori depict the human body in their ceremonial carvings, to an outsider, it can look like this beautiful geometrical patterns. But then the big question is, yeah, but where's the human being? And if you have someone who's initiated into this way of seeing, you may see that this one swirl is an arm, and another swirl is a shoulder, and another swirl is a leg. And those swirls may look beautiful to an outsider, but they may actually represent parts of the body to someone who's familiar with these conventions. And so when we depict something, it isn't simply that we're depicting what's really there in a way that's really clear, that there are a lot of assumptions, even in how we show something as concrete as the human body. Or take this representation of the human being from the Abalam of Papua New Guinea. Again, a beautiful geometrical pattern, some might say, you might be able to discern where arms and legs are, and then four circles that represent eyes. Or, as the Abalam know, they're also stars, because the stars are the eyes of the ancestors looking down on us. And so the way we represent ourselves is not often just a simple depiction of the human body devoid of other cultural context. And so if we really want to communicate that to another civilization, we need to take some steps to help them see as we do. Good example of helping another civilization see as we do comes in the Voyager spacecraft. This included on one side music from around the world. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. It also included over 100 images. And one of the images was a picture of two young men hunting an antelope. What you notice is in our photographs, objects that are in the foreground appear much larger than objects in the background. That antelope may be the same size as its hunters, but it takes up a very small part of the picture. And so once we've communicated something about length and distance, we can start unpacking how our two-dimensional representations help us describe living in a three-dimensional world. But maybe we don't want to restrict ourselves just to depicting objects in a physical world. Maybe what we should be doing is thinking of more creative ways to use possibly universal concepts in mathematics. The physicist Louis Lamb has suggested that if you're a geometer on another world, you might well be familiar with the idea of an equilateral triangle. So this is a triangle that all three sides are the same length, all of three corners have the same angle, and that if you're familiar with an equilateral triangle, then it's actually a short and very elegant step to describing a fractal. And a fractal is a pattern that repeats over and over and over. So if we take that equilateral triangle and then carve another equilateral triangle out of the middle of it, we end up with three equilateral triangles at the corner and another triangle in the inside. And then if we carve each of those up and carve each of those up and keep on going over and over and over, we get what's called the Sierpinski gasket after the person who discovered this pattern. The interesting thing is, so this is something that can be described in some very basic computer code. but it also seems to tap into some of the patterns that we see as aesthetic representations here on Earth. You'll see them in the tile patterns of some cathedrals in Europe. You'll see them in the leatherwork of the Tuareg from Africa. So there are some of our aesthetic sensibilities that can be described in some very simple mathematical terms. Another example is the Fibonacci series. So we've seen how we can start with basic counting to get to a description of chemistry. But similarly, we could start with counting, but counting in a bit different way to get to an idea of proportions that seems to pervade our perception of beauty in nature and in artificially created objects. And the pattern is a very simple one. We start with one and add one together. And one and one is two. And when we add one and two together, we get three. We add two and three together, we get five. And if you lay these out on a two-dimensional space, kind of pile them up next to one another, what you'll see is that if you draw a spiral connecting these individual squares that are one and one and two and three and five and eight in their side length, you'll get a spiral that's actually very similar to the spiral that we see in nautilus shells, and it's because it's tied into growth patterns. And you'll also see those proportions, some have argued, in things that we human beings have created. So if you look at the Parthenon in Greece, this monument to wisdom, you'll see inscribed in the front of it repeatedly these proportions of the Fibonacci series. And so composer Andrew Kaiser and I have suggested that if we want to send a message to another civilization, maybe it should start with something as simple as sending a series of pulses that have the Fibonacci series encoded in them. In this case, you might have a pulse, and then a silence, and another pulse, and then another silence, and a couple of pulses, and then a silence, and then more pulses, pulsing out the sequence of the Fibonacci series. And you can do that both in the pulses themselves and inversely in the silences in between, or simply having tones of differing lengths that you're sending. And once you get to the idea of sending tones of a certain duration, you're getting very close to something like music. Now, the example that we might all think of from Hollywood when you have music from an alien is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I would love it if a mothership came to Earth and started cranking out this great symphony. But in the meantime, the question is, how might we incorporate some of those insights into how we would communicate with other beings? Well, once again, we find that the idea of communicating through a musical language is nothing new. We've all heard of Cyrano de Bergerac. For those of you who saw the play here at Bates a couple of months ago, you may be thinking of the person with the large nose. But, you know, what's often overlooked is Cyrano de Bergerac was a novelist. And he wrote in the genre of the 17th century imaginary voyages. And one of the imaginary voyages that he talked about was a voyage to the moon. And of course, as everyone knew in the 17th century, if you wanted to get to the moon, your best means of getting there is to find a dozen or so geese and strap a chariot to them, because in the winter time the geese go to the moon. And so when he did, he encountered lunarians, inhabitants of the moon, who spoke a very musical language. Now, maybe this wasn't exactly Cyrano de Bergerac's sole creation. It seems like it could have been inspired by European Jesuits' contacts with Chinese, which is a tonal language. But nonetheless, the idea that maybe this tonal language, a music-like language, could be used to communicate is something that has a long history. as I mentioned, when the Voyager recording was sent out, there was a sampling of music from around the world. And in fact, the one side included images, as I've discussed, and the final image on the picture side shows a string quartet and one of the instruments along with the score. And then you flip it over and you start hearing the music that has been transcribed on the opposite side. Now, this was a NASA project, so there was an emphasis on the Western classical tradition, a lot of Bach and Beethoven. Johnny B. Goode was included. The Beatles were actually offered a slot, but they turned it down for copyright reasons. I mean, what were they thinking? They could have been out there. And, you know, one of the things all of these musics have in common is that they're written in a 12-tone scale. Some have argued that there are actually good reasons to think that a 12-tone scale might not be that alien to an extraterrestrial, if they have some of the same things they're looking for in the music that we do. One of the nice things about a 12-tone scale is it lets us slice up an octave into 12 pieces. And by slicing an octave up into 12 pieces, where you know you double the frequency and you have a new octave, you slice it up into 12 pieces, and you have a nice characteristic that you can do a pretty good job of starting your scale on any one of those notes, and the relationship between the notes sounds good. You can have polyphonic music with a 12-tone scale. And so you can't do that as well with if you slice it up in terms of other numbers. One other combination that works really well is a 5-tone scale. So maybe we would expect some pentatonic music, and we see that in a number of Asian musics. Another possibility is a 31-tone scale, but imagine the hands you'd need to play a keyboard on that world. But one of the nice things, if we would send a music, a message that is modeled after our music, and if it's recognized as such, it also gives the recipient a bit of an understanding about how we hear the world. Because in order to be able to slice up an octave into 5 or 12 or 31 pieces, we need to have the ability to make distinctions between intervals that small. So in a sense, communicating something about our way of hearing and creating music says something about us as beings. Similarly, as we think about how we sequence sounds to make a good melody or for something to sound harmonic, there are certain rules that some have suggested reflect a cognitive structuring. So this might be a way, music might be a way to start explaining to extraterrestrials a little bit about how we think. In fact, the Dutch logician Alexander Ollongren has suggested, you know, instead of starting with something like math or logic as the beginning and then moving on to music, maybe start with music and how we have well-formed music and the patterns of music and use that to illustrate how we logically structure the world. Well, so these are some of the ideas that specialists from around a range of disciplines around the world have been thinking about over the past many years. But if we really make contact with another civilization, if we do get a signal someday, it seems wrong-headed that the decision should be made by a handful of specialists. And so at the SETI Institute, we've launched a project called Earth Speaks. And we're asking people from around the world to tell us what kind of message would you want to send to an extraterrestrial. And I would invite all of you at the end of this talk to go online. It's earthspeaks.seti.org. Do it yourself. If you're a teacher, do it in your classrooms. Let me just give you a sampling of some of the messages that we have been getting in. We have right now messages from over 70 countries around the world. And some of them actually start out very similar to some of the more mathematically minded messages we've already talked about, notions of equality, 0 equals 0, 1 equals 1, 2 equals 2. Others will try to identify number sequences that could have some universal significance, like this is something that came from Zurich, a prime number sequence. 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17. What do those numbers have in common? They're only divisible by themselves and 1. They can't be divided by any other numbers. From the Czech Republic, depictions of how we would show numbers and the relationship to geometrical objects. But other people wanted to emphasize our visual sense. And in Earth Speaks, you can send text messages, you can send images, you can send sounds. And so one contributor from Mexico sent an image of an eye. And as you send your messages, you can also send a tag so that you can search for other similar sorts of messages that other people have contributed. This tag was actually quite a lengthy one. Many of them are very brief, one or two words. But her description is astronomy started by observing the stars with our eyes. And if in fact extraterrestrials had inspiration for astronomy in the same way, maybe they would recognize something like an eye. Other images are of beautiful objects, such as a beautiful astronomical scene. And one of the common themes was trying to communicate to another civilization where we are, where do we fit in to this galaxy. So one text message said, "Hello, this is Earth. We're a planet about 28,000 light years from the center of the galaxy and about 20 light years above the galaxy's equatorial plane. It's within what we call the Orion spiral arm." And a summary of this is it's a hello, it's a greetings, and there's another tag here, help, which we'll see more of a little bit later. But this idea of describing where we are in our galaxy has been repeated. One picture that came in from Les Ulis, France, showed a picture of the contributor's home city and then where that city is on the Earth and where the Earth is in the broader cosmos. Another common theme that you'll see is where do humans fit into this natural world, both culturally, the things that we create, the impact that we're having on our ecosystem. Several of the messages show this depiction of humankind as a progression of hominid evolution from the brutish ape to the upright, intelligent human being. And there's this implicit sense, I think, of finally we've reached the pinnacle of evolution. There's another message I like even better because I think it really characterizes who is at the pinnacle of evolution, at least here on Earth. And that's a message that says, please make sure you don't hurt the cats. And of course, my real fear is that the aliens will be sort of like cats, that they'll know we're here, they just don't care about it. But other messages will try to reflect something about the range of how we are as human beings. This one from Alaska says, "Welcome to planet Earth, and yes, we are quite insane." Another suggests that we're hoping, some of us are hoping to know you, others are afraid of you, the rest don't believe in you, so that we may have very different responses from one to the other, some welcoming and some not so sure about making contact. From New Zealand, we got a message, "As much as some of us would like to meet you, most of us will be too afraid to handle your very existence. Be prepared." And so this sense of ambivalence is captured, too, if you look just at a microscopic level at the words. So one of the things we did is to look at how often are the words in these messages used compared to English use in general. And no surprise, we're seeing words like galaxy and world and even humankind used much more often in these messages. So a common theme is we are the humans of planet Earth. So we see those sorts of words much more common. But how do you explain the fact that we see the word but 150 times more often than English in general? Well, it's because it comes in statements like, I would like to make contact, but other people here aren't ready for it. So there's this sense of that we're divided in how we would respond to the detection of life beyond Earth. One of the themes that is seen from around the world is a simple one of help us, from Australia, a simple, succinct help. Sometimes people elaborate in the ways that they want help. So welcome. We hope you have an ability to help us be better people. Teach us to listen, learn, and persevere. Thank you. This one from Minnesota. Please help save our planet Earth. Some of our species are destroying it, and the rest of us cannot stop them. And so we're seeing some of these expressed visually as well. For example, global warming by seeing a polar bear on a very small fragment of an ice floe. And so there's a lot of solemnity, a lot of seriousness, a lot of concern that is being reflected in the messages that people would want to say to another civilization. But there's also a lot of the messages that we get that really capture one of the quintessential characteristics of human beings, which is our sense of humor. And one of the favorite ones that has come in, it comes from Tallinn, Estonia, someone who says, "Hello, please come pick me up. I'm a librarian, artist, and I prepare great earth dishes." What a better way of showing altruism to another civilization, right? So up till now, we have not yet detected a signal from another civilization, but our observations begin in less than an hour for yet another day. And if we do detect a signal, one of the big questions will be, what should we say? I do hope each of you will go to our website, earthspeaks.seti.org, and let us know how you would want to contribute to an interstellar dialogue that could last a long, long, long time. Thank you.
I have a question. How do you deal with the reality that we sense the world and our surroundings through our five senses? And we can't assume that any extraterrestrials would have the same five senses that we have. And if they don't have the same five senses that we have, how do you communicate?
You are exactly on target about the sorts of challenges that we face. Because one of the examples that we talked about is even if we do have a shared sense, like vision, and we're communicating across cultures here on Earth about the same object, we may have a hard time. So how do we go beyond? And you know, this is always the challenge of SETI. How do we try to anticipate an intelligence that we have not made contact with? And so what we do is to look for analogies here on Earth. So you raise the question of senses. If we look at the senses that we rely on as human beings, one rough way to get a sense of which are our most important senses is to look at how much of our cerebral cortex is used to process the information from our different senses. And so you'll see that a lot of it is used to process visual information and audition, hearing. So we're largely visual and largely auditory creatures. But one of the things that's very specific about being a visual, an auditory creature, is it shapes the way we see our world. I mean, we all talk about the relativity in time and space, but we think in some sense, you know, when you're traveling near the speed of light, okay, everything is very different from here, but here concretely, this is really the way the world is, right? To us. But one of the things about vision and hearing is it lets us locate objects very clearly in both time and space. An object comes into the room, an object leaves the room, it's here. If you have, say, an olfactory sense, say you smell through a sense, you communicate and you perceive the world through a sense of smell, it may be much more graded. You know, it's kind of like walking into a crowded elevator and there's a strong scent of perfume. Is it someone who's there now or someone who got off on the floor below? And so what may be clear in one sensory modality may not be clear in another. How do we deal with that problem? We try to expand as much as we can by looking at least at those non-human senses that we can get access to on this world. And then we try to abstract our communications from the senses in more abstract terms, like mathematical terms, and link them to our physical senses in as many different ways as we can. But it's a tremendous challenge, and I appreciate that.
One of the things that we learned from exhibitions like Starstruck is that space is a really big place, and so there are vast distances, as you said, between our solar system or our galaxy and other places, stars that might have planets around them. So, is there any how is SETI dealing with issues of the immense amount of time that these messages need to travel? Will there be consistencies over the centuries as these messages are sent and hopefully received?
Yeah, it's a really critical point that what we assume as we're doing SETI now is that the other civilization has to be much longer lived. I made reference to this in the past, and you're probably saying, why do you assume that? It doesn't have to be the case. A civilization has the ability to create a radio telescope, and then they either annihilate themselves in a nuclear war, or they get tired of exploring outward and they turn inward. And those are all possible trajectories for what can happen when you have advanced technology. But if that's what happens, then we're not going to make contact. So right now, we're listening. There have been some periodic transmissions, but nothing substantial. There have been more symbolic efforts. So what we're doing now is listening. And what we do is we listen to one star for a few minutes, and then we move on to the next, and then on to the next. And so what that means is, for us to succeed, practically speaking, the other civilization needs to be transmitting all the time. And not just now, but they've probably been transmitting for thousands or even millions of years. So we count on that in order to be able to succeed. I mean, otherwise, it's kind of like, you know, maybe other civilizations have the ability to communicate for as long as we've had it, less than 100 years. But if that's true, then it's like in the course of a long night, you have two fireflies that each flick on once. What's the chance it's going to be at the exact same moment? The only way is if you have a very long-term beacon. So the impact of that on SETI is that many people have said we should be putting our energies into listening. Save the burden of transmitting to the civilizations who've been around. They've been around a few thousand or million years. They're more confident that they'll stick around. And we take the less onerous task. The challenge is, and that's great, if that's actually what the other civilizations agree to do. The difficulty is maybe everyone's waiting, and it's like, oh, we're only a million years old. Come on, let the guys who are a billion years do it. And so I think we should actually have a richer strategy where we're both listening and transmitting. Because one of the things about transmitting, too, is that it creates the culture of anticipation, that it helps us. As human beings, we are beings who are bound to time, and we see in terms of our time and in terms of our future. I think a future in which we can, 25 and 50 and 100 years from now, potentially have a reply back from this star or this star or this star, is a future that really helps us sustain the listening SETI over long terms as well.
Thank you, by the way. I learned an awful lot today. I'm just curious, as director of interstellar message composition, what's a typical day like for you at SETI?
A lot of what I do is to help identify people from disciplines in the social sciences, humanities, and arts who haven't been involved in SETI. So we're very well known by radio astronomers. SETI grew up within the radio astronomy community. So much of my day involves putting together conference sessions, editing books, where we get anthropologists and musicians and sociologists to really start grappling with a lot of these issues. Because just in the great questions that you're asking, we're seeing that these aren't purely scientific answers. I mean, they're not answers that... there are questions in order to succeed in SETI that go well beyond the range of science. We need to appreciate the scientific nature of the search, but the societal impacts are that much bigger. So a lot of my day is to identify people whose voices haven't been heard, both professionals who are involved in scholarly activities, and I'm also the one who's leading up the Earth Speaks project, and we've recently expanded that to Mexico as well, and so we hope to add more and more languages beyond English and Spanish.
Are you only listening in radio waves or in any other part of the spectrum?
You know, so the question is, are we listening only in radio waves or other parts of the spectrum? When SETI started back in 1960, the strong, almost unanimous consensus was radio is the only way to go. Radio's nice. You know, all electromagnetic radiation travels at the speed of light, so you want that. I mean, the distances are immense, so don't choose something that's going to be slow. But radio is also nice because it cuts through our atmosphere, and it cuts through the cosmic static as well. There are quiet spaces in the spectrum where we can listen to radio. Now, there was a lone voice back in the early 60s that said, you know, you could also look at optical wavelengths. And his name was Charles Townes, and he won a Nobel Prize for inventing the laser. But people said, Charlie, you're crazy. I mean, no civilization has the ability to create a technology that can send a laser pulse, because at laser frequencies, it would need to be a much more powerful pulse. And you can't imagine a civilization that could do that. Well, it's 50 years later, and now we can imagine doing it ourselves. And so we have now been looking for the last 10 years or so. And part of what makes it possible is that in optical SETI, we're not looking for a continuous signal. We're looking for a little blip, a billionth of a second long. And one of the nice things that lets us do that relatively inexpensively is that there are off-the-shelf technologies developed for other applications that let us detect these nanosecond pulses. So if you're sending only a very brief signal over a long period of time, it doesn't take that much energy. You put it all into one very brief time. So the lesson here is, yes, it's important to be realistic about what you are looking for, and to think of a plausible way that this technology could be constructed. But we also have to remember that we sometimes lose track that our own imagination may restrict us. So it's always this tension between being scientifically grounded and looking at realistic extrapolations. But when we do find those realistic extrapolations, then we need to search there, because honestly, they could be transmitting at radio or optical frequencies.
As human beings, we tend to filter stimuli through a screen that determines whether or not the messages would be coming from a benign source or a non-benign source. And I'm wondering what kinds of premises you operate on with respect to whether a civilization advanced enough to send out signals we could pick up would be benign or non-benign, or whether that's even a question you worry about.
Well, it is a question that we consider. A couple of years ago, Stephen Hawking suggested, whatever you want to do, do not transmit, because the aliens may come here and take over our world. And, you know, at the face of it, that seems like a reasonable argument. It's certainly reasonable enough to be cautious. And so the thing is, if you look at arguments like that, it becomes a question of what are plausible motivations. And so for a civilization to come to Earth, in Hawking's scenario, they would want our natural resources. It seems a little far-fetched that you would come across the galaxy to get something that you might get closer to home and expend all the energy. It's kind of like spending $70,000 to get a paperback through Amazon. I mean, you could do it, but does it really pay off? Or maybe they would see us as a threat, and so they would want to take us out. But again, if they have the ability to travel between the stars, are we really going to be a threat? So I don't think you can absolutely rule out the possibility that an extraterrestrial has malevolent intentions. But the question is, do they have the capability to act on them? And if they're really malevolent, why haven't they already been here and wiped us out? I mean, if a civilization really needs what we have on Earth, and they have the ability to come here, they didn't need to wait for radio signals in order to get an invitation.
If there was an alien species communicating with another species, and we just happened to be in the flight path, and they were using quantum entanglement for their communication. Would we be able to detect that?
I think there are a couple of things that would make it challenging. One is we would have to be right in the line of sight. So given, we're assuming that civilizations aren't everywhere, because if they were, we would have already detected them. So if that's the truth, if they're relatively rare, then to have two relatively rare civilizations communicating and we're right in the middle of them seems a little unlikely. So it's possible that we might be able to detect a signal. There's a physicist at the University of Hawaii, Walt Simmons, who's actually suggested using quantum entanglement as a strategy for transmitting to another civilization in a way that could conceal what your location is, so that you could use that if you do have concerns that transmitting could bring a hostile alien toward Earth. You might want to go to the extremes of trying to conceal it. So depending on how the signal is encoded, my sense is we probably would not detect that given the way that we're looking for signals right now. But if you had a sufficiently clear idea of what you were looking for and could anticipate what the key would be, you may be able to. But again, there'd still be the constraint of the geometry of, are you really going to be between two civilizations? I think it's unlikely, but possible.
Perhaps one more question?
There have been numerous documentaries, and, you know, sometimes you can call them amateur, but I don't know if the non-amateur documentaries, you know, have any more of a clout, you know. Anyway, there were documentaries suggesting that, let's say, you know, some of these pyramids, like in Giza and South America, lie in the same general belt, and that there's a possibility that these are, you know, maybe even transmitters in themselves. Has there been any effort, or have you ever considered that at SETI Institute? And has there been any effort in maybe trying to haul the equipment in there and try to listen right at the locations?
We haven't attempted, say, to go to the pyramids to listen. And I think part of it is just a constraint. I mean, we're set up as astronomers to be looking outward. So it would take a different sort of instrumentation to be searching for signals from on Earth. And then the other question is, whenever there are attributions of intelligence of an extraterrestrial nature because of geometrical alignments, how do we determine whether it is really from an extraterrestrial or whether that's a human imposition onto the object? You know, the example that I talked about with the Parthenon, of the Fibonacci series being inscribed into it, was that really in the mind of the creators of the Parthenon, or is that later theorists who are looking at that and imputing it? So I think that's where we would want to be cautious. Part of the other reason that at the SETI Institute we don't focus on phenomena like pyramids is, it's not clear how you'd get something replicable. You know, as we're looking for a signal, what we want is something that we can read on a meter somewhere and that other astronomers can also confirm independently. I mean, it's certainly imaginable how you might be able to measure things at places on Earth, but I would think people from other specialties or people focused on Earth-based research would be better able to do that.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Douglas Vakoch, the Director of Interstellar Message Composition at the SETI Institute, on Speaking in Maine here on listener-supported Maine Public Radio. He spoke recently in Lewiston at the Bates College Museum of Art. If you enjoyed this program and wish to have a copy for yourself, one can be purchased by calling MPBN's audience services at 1-800-884-1717. Again, to purchase a copy of today's Speaking in Maine program featuring Dr. Douglas Vakoch, call MPBN's audience services at 1-800-884-1717. The program will also be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can find the programs both in streaming and podcast formats, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.